This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
When you and I last chatted, the world was very different.
It was a long time ago, wasn't it? Well, it seems like a whole other era, but it was only 4 years ago. But so much has happened in the last 4 years. It's been crazy, isn't it? I think they've packed a whole century of history into 4 years. And we're all disorientated, aren't we? Because, you know, we talk about something and then, you know, some absolutely, you know, incredible event takes place 1 week and then another thing the next week. It just goes on and on. But yeah, the world has changed. I don't know if it's changed for the better.
That's an interesting question. I've never actually ever asked anybody this on my podcast. So I think I'm going to ask you. So for the very first time, Dave, if you could go back to 2019, in other words, before the whole COVID thing started, knowing what you know now, would you want to go back?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question to answer, isn't it? Because if you go back and then you don't have lockdowns and you don't have injections and all these kind of things, you don't know what would have happened. I mean, there's no way of actually knowing what the alternative timeline is. So, you know, we're here. And the thing is, for me, I now know so much more than I did before this all started. Back in 2019, the big battle in the UK was still for Brexit. That's where we were. And then that finished. And then all this other craziness started. But, you know, I know so much more now. I'm more aware of things. I've learned so much. I've made so many incredible friends and connections and people. I mean, that's what it's about. I know so many more wonderful people today that I didn't know 4 years ago that I would say no. I mean, I wouldn't change it.
I agree. I was actually asked that question a few months ago by a friend, and I've thought about that. And I think I agree with you. I don't think I'd want to go back. I quite like where we are now. I feel I'm more enlightened, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, enlightened, awake, I don't know. I don't tend to use those words myself anymore, but aware. I'm more aware of what's going on. I've got more knowledge of what's happening. I can see I've joined more dots and, you know, maybe I've been down more rabbit holes, you know, and looked into things which everyone would like to smear as conspiracy theories, but you're actually just finding out facts. You know, I'm interested in truth and what is the truth of how things are. And I know a lot more truth today than I did 4 years ago.
I don't like the word awake either, but what's wrong with the word enlightenment?
I think, you know, there's two things about enlightenment. I mean, one, people sort of tend to associate it with the enlightenment of the 18th century, which was, you know, as a Christian, I think there's some good things to enlightenment, bringing about reason and logic and rationality, but then you lose some of the mystery of the world. So, you know, one use of the word enlightenment is just to, you know, the sort of enlightenment of the mind in terms of logic and reason. The other word, enlightenment, you know, it's sort of associated with, you know, you being a person that is enlightened yourself, you know, individually without God. So to me, as Christian, that's a different thinking. It's not Christian thinking. It's actually occult thinking. That's why I don't use it.
It's got that sort of new agey feel to it.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. You are illuminated, illuminati, enlightened, the same kind of word. But that's all about you becoming awake, you finding something in yourself without any relationship with God or Jesus Christ, who is the Savior. I mean, Jesus is the hope of the world, and we need him, not all of us, you know, looking into ourselves and trying to work our way to enlightenment ourselves. So I think, you know, just because I'm coming from a Christian thinking, you know, way of thinking, that's why I don't use that word.
It is a good point, because I have noticed, maybe you have also, that a lot of people fighting the good fight, quote unquote, over the last few years, they tend to overlap with a lot of that new agey stuff.
Yeah, indeed. And back in 2020, I mean, I was very surprised, you know, and it was a welcome surprise when I started up the Heritage Party as a socially conservative party, but also to fight for freedom in what was going on at the time with lockdowns and injections, that had a lot of Christians coming to the party. But I also had a lot of people who were, you know, what you would call New Age, which isn't actually new. It's actually very old, but it's all spiritual, you know, spiritual without being religious. if you like. And
yes.
Yeah. And a lot of people were attracted to the Heritage Party and me and, you know, the freedom movement from that kind of walk of life. And that was something that I didn't ever expect to see, but it did. And, you know, absolutely lovely people, you know. And I remember I went to speak in Glastonbury one time in 2021, which is, you know, the center of New Age, the spirituality and whatever in the UK. But, you know, the audience there let me speak about my Christian faith, and they were very, very polite, very exceptionally respectful to me when I spoke about it. And that was absolutely lovely of them to do that.
I have noticed what appears to be, it's weird. On the one hand, I've seen an increase in people becoming Christian, although we can talk about that because I sometimes wonder if that's legit or not. I mean, like Russell Brand and Jordan Peterson, I get very weird feelings about that. And I don't want to be too cynical because they could be genuine. And then on the other hand, I've seen this attack on Christianity in the last few years from people who see it as a psyop, you know, because it's like a control mechanism. David Icke has been very vocal on this lately. I don't know if you've noticed. But then what are you left with? What, atheism? And I think that's very empty and very much what the technocrats are aiming for.
They're all empty, you know. I think, yeah, you're right. There's atheism in a way is losing ground because I think we're over the last 4 years, everybody is looking for something, some meaning. The idea that there is nothing spiritual, there is only material. I mean, it's Marx, Darwin, atheism, whatever you like it. It's, you know, everyone realizes, I think, that there's more than just the physical world. We're in a battle of good and evil. And, you know, even if you just say that, then you're acknowledging that there's some spiritual dimension to where we are. And atheism just doesn't cut it because when you realize you're in a battle, a spiritual battle, as lots of people say, then obviously there's some spiritual forces there that atheism doesn't allow for the existence of. So I think it's losing ground there. But yeah, I mean, David Icke and so on. I like David. I've met him. You know, I get on very well with him as a person. And he's absolutely spot on so many things, on the EU, on globalists, on the World Economic Forum and all that. But when he goes off into the spiritual matters, he is very anti-Christian in what he says. And I think he's coming from this New Age perspective, which is not new. As I said, it's Gnosticism repackaged for the 21st century. I mean, Gnosticism sort of says that the Christian God is actually the demiurge, is actually evil. And then there's other entities around which are the good ones, you know, where that doesn't make much sense. But also then David Icke would say, well, actually, this world doesn't exist at all. We're all a hologram, you know, so that doesn't make any sense either. You know, so I don't know. But then you get people like that, Russell Brand, as you mentioned, who I think was very, very New Agey before, has suddenly had a conversion to Christianity. You know, only God can judge what is really in his heart, you know, because he went and he's filming himself and he's making his Christianity and conversion and baptism. It's a big media event. And, you know, I listened to what he said about it. And I think it's one of the most narcissistic speeches about his baptism I've ever heard in my life. So, there's not much in there about God or Jesus or recognizing that you need repentance from your sins and you need to your salvation through Jesus Christ and to live another life. You know, these words are absent from his lexicon still. It's all about having an experience and being enlightened. He's still using that New Age language. So, you know, I hope his conversion is genuine. Mm. I hope he's genuinely given his life to the Lord. But if he has, then we'll see over the years him actually maturing in how he acts and what he says. But, you know, I can't say. It's only God can say.
I was listening to a podcast recently in which Richard Dawkins was being interviewed, and I couldn't do more than 15 minutes. I just found him so bitter and empty. And I do wonder if holding that kind of position is healthy.
It isn't healthy at all, is it? Because your soul is cut off from God, who is your creator. You know, and people often ask me, well, how do you stay so happy with all of these things going on? I mean, or joyful, whatever. How do you be how you are? And it's only through Jesus. It's only through knowing God and him filling me with his life and his spirit every day, you know. And I sin every day, you know. So I'm not a good person. I need him to forgive me every day for things I do wrong, you know. But Richard Richard Dawkins, who is actively against any God, any creator, anything that is immaterial. I mean, he is the consummate materialist, isn't he? He's an atheist. He believes there's nothing beyond the material world. I don't know how you can live like that, you know, not deliberately cutting yourself off from that. But the interesting thing about Richard Dawkins now is he's actually speaking on behalf of cultural Christianity, and he spent all of his life attacking Christianity, and now Islam is on the march in Europe, and he sees that as more of a threat. And he's almost, in a way, at sometimes hiding behind Christianity as a bulwark against Islam, saying, well, I don't agree with Christianity, but the cultural and traditional aspects of it are good, and I like them, and I'd much rather have them than Islam coming into Europe. So there's a very interesting paradox there in how he is developing as the years go by.
It's funny you mentioned immigration into Europe. I was in Europe a year ago now, and I mean, it's beautiful. It's absolutely stunning. You know, the history is magical. But it seems very empty now. I don't mean empty in terms of population, but empty in terms of the people. You know, just loads of individuals walking around with headphones or headsets and looking into their phone. No connection with anybody around them. LGBTQ flags everywhere. And it's very difficult to know where you are unless you actually, you know, look on a map, because it's so multicultural that the essence of where I was, it seems to be lost.
It's an incredible tragedy how Europe had everything 50, 60 years ago, and we've just thrown it all away. And not just thrown it all away, we've like thrown it to the ground and trampled on it. I mean, not me personally, but the people of Europe collectively. I mean, it's so horrible because we had a beautiful civilization. You know, it is beautiful. There's still some things there. Beautiful buildings and architecture, beautiful music, beautiful culture. And it's founded on Christianity, of course, and it's profoundly a Christian continent. But since, I guess, the 1960s, that has been severely attacked over and over again by cultural Marxism and cultural movements, which is a deliberate attempt to get into universities and undermine traditional values and Christian principles that we've had for 1,000, 1,500 years or more, and replace them with other things, to criticize it with critical theory, and not just Christianity, but to undermine the family, undermine the nation states that we have, undermine our culture, take the mick out of our culture, make fun of it, and replace it with other things which are degenerate, which is why you've got all this LGBT stuff, Black Lives Matter stuff, the critical race theory that says white people are racist and then men are oppressive, and you must atone for that in this new religion. You know, it's like a new religion that says you are sinners because you are white and indigenous, and therefore to atone for your sin in this new secular religion, you must embrace homosexuality, transgenderism, open borders, migration, even to the point where you actually abolish yourselves because you are bad because you are white and you are Christian and you are European. And that is the new secular religion of the age. And it is absolutely horrible and destructive. And, you know, I see it and I say, this is wrong. And we need to stand against it. I think a lot of people realize that we need to stand against this now, but they don't know how. Because they're so bludgeoned down with all of these smear words and, you know, very, very powerful behavioral psychology techniques that are used in order to get people to shut up about what's going on and just accept it. But, you know, to be honest with you, I see the only hope that we have as Europe is to return to Christianity, and not just Christianity, to return to Christ, the person of Jesus, who is the center of Christianity, from which all the teaching and the relationship with God flows from. And, you know, without that, we're lost. And that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, I saw when I was going around Amsterdam last year, there were many churches, but all museums empty. You know, people just don't go to church anymore. It's very sad. In actual fact, the one church had a big LGBTQ flag on it.
But this is part of the problem, isn't it? Some of the churches are actually going along with the new religion, if you like, and trying to be inclusive. It's this diversity, equality, and inclusion, which is a religion. So in order to show that you're good, you have to be inclusive of everybody. And, you know, even to the point of actually going against what the Bible says, which is that you need to give up your sin. Yes, God loves everyone, and God has made atonement for everyone. Everyone can be a Christian. Everyone can be a child of God, but you have to give up your sin. You can't continue openly and brazenly living lifestyles which are spoken against in the Bible. You know, but some of these people, basically, they've got rid of God, they've got rid of the Bible, and they just want to say, we're nice. But that's not nice, you know, actually, at the end of the day. And of course, hardly anyone's going to go, and all of these places are just going to shut. And, you know, what will happen in time is Muslims will take them over. And that's what you're seeing happening in the UK quite a lot. A lot of old church buildings are either going to ruin, you know, in the 80s and 90s, a lot of them turned into pubs and nightclubs and so on, which, you know, is quite distressing to see that happening. But now you've got a different move. Muslims are buying up old church buildings and converting them into mosques because they have a, you know, I'm obviously I'm not recommending Islam at all, but they have an active and virulent faith, and they have a mission to turn Britain and Europe into a caliphate. They tell us exactly what they're going to do. I mean, they don't keep it a secret. That's what they want to do, and they're getting on with what they want to do. And unless we, as the indigenous people of Europe, return to Christ, return to Christianity, people can say, oh, this is terrible. Oh, there's all these churches turning into mosques. But, well, go then. Go to church. Support them. You know, otherwise this is inevitable and it's going to happen.
Christianity is worth fighting for.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah. Jesus died for our sins. I mean, you can't make more of a sacrifice than that, the original sacrifice. And it is because, you know, our civilization has been so good. People talk about 50 or 60 years ago, a high trust civilization where everyone has shared principles or values which are good. We all understand how to behave in society, which is based on the Ten Commandments, essentially. Don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't lie, bear false testimony against your neighbor, and don't covet what other people have, be content with what you have. And also the commandments about God as well, you know, having no other gods before me and so on. If you follow those Ten Commandments, those are fantastic as a foundation for any society and civilization. But when you turn your back on it, then, you know, what does God do in that? When we have everything and everything has been passed down to us from our forefathers, and then a generation comes up and says, well, that's great, but I don't want that. I want to go and do my own thing. I mean, our whole civilization is like the prodigal son that has everything in the father's house, but has gone and said, I don't want that. I want my inheritance now, and I'm going to go off and party and, you know, do all this stuff. And you end up eating swill with the pigs. And that's where we are now. But the good news is we can return to God. He's waiting for us to return, but it needs us to get off, you know, our backsides and actually do something about it and stop just going, oh, this is dreadful, you know, and we're going to carry on letting all these degenerate things happen. We need to go back to God. And that's the only way that the West is going to get back to anything good and pleasant and homely and a civilization that you would want to live in again and that has any similarity to what we had before.
You mentioned indigenous people earlier. This is a very interesting point. So I'm a white South African, but I consider myself African. I don't consider myself European. I know that my ancestry is European, but we're talking hundreds of years ago, many, many generations. And I think it's fair to say that enough time or enough generations have passed for me to classify. I mean, when I was in Europe, they, you know, wanted me to leave at a certain, I mean, that's the point of a visa. I can't stay because I'm not European. And adding to that, if people are going to move into your, let's say, your country, your nation, your region, whatever, I think it's only fair, Dave, that they adopt the culture and the traditions of that area. Would you agree?
Yes, I think so. Or at least respect them. You know, for say I went to live in Thailand, I wouldn't become a Buddhist and I probably wouldn't go to the temple, but I would respect them. And I'm not going to say, oh, look, I don't like you ringing your temple bells. I'm going to like play rap music and, you know, on whenever you ring them because I don't like yours. And I'm going to impose my culture on you. Not that rap music is my culture, but just as an example, you know, I'm not going to play Western music, you know, when you're doing your Thai things, you know. So I think that's what the attitude people need to come into the West with, as anyone should have going anywhere, that you're going somewhere because you like a place, you want to learn from a place, you want to contribute to a place, and you will respect its culture and you will not seek to destroy it. You know, that's just basic, you know, good manners. But I think a lot of people don't have those.
Yeah, I was kind of alluding to where I'm going now, and that is with Europe, there are there are a lot of issues, but the couple that I want to mention are, as you pointed out, Muslims wanting to come in, Islam wanting to take over and make Europe Muslim again, so to speak. But the other issue is the EU, because it's allowing in the mass immigration. I was in China a few months ago, and there's no mass immigration.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? It's the only countries that are seemingly not just allowing it, but facilitating it. Our Western countries, so there's the EU, there's the UK, there's the USA, Canada are also doing the same. You've got massive immigration there under Biden and under Trudeau. And it seems it's all happening in lockstep together. So there is some concerted plan in order to bring in as many migrants from third world countries as possible in order to replace and overwhelm the indigenous population. I mean, this is not just a few people now. I mean, we just had figures from the UK up to 2023, were released yesterday, 677,000 migrants net came to the UK in 1 year. That's 1% of the population. And it's going up all the time. You say the EU as well, they're doing it. Obviously, Germany, since 2015, has had a program of incredible mass immigration, and it's causing huge amounts of problems, particularly for the women who are there, because, you know, a lot of people coming are single men from Muslim countries or, you know, foreign countries, and they don't respect women in the same way that we do here. They see someone and they treat her like a chattel, or they expect that they will do what they're told, and, you know, they make relationships with them, and then a woman says, no, I don't want to date you anymore, and then they go and kill her because they've shamed them. This happens. This has happened many, many times in many, many European countries. It's making life very, very unsafe for people in Europe in particular. You've got the situation in the UK as well, where a Rwandan migrant, or the son of Rwandan migrants, went and stabbed 11 young children in a Taylor Swift dance class. You know, and three of them were killed. This is just one example. I mean, I'm no fan of Taylor Swift. I know I wouldn't recommend Taylor Swift for kids, but you know, I mean, the fact is, I suppose this person thought that, you know, this is something that I don't like, so I'm going to kill the people who are dancing. You know,
I also want to bomb cities when I hear Taylor Swift.
Oh dear, oh dear. You know, it's
But I mean, look. Okay, look. All right, hang on. Disclaimer: that was a joke. We need to put that in just in case somebody gets very offended. It's terrible. Yes, of course it's terrible. Just making a joke about Taylor Swift people. The other issue, though, is we're talking about what we can see. That's mass immigration. It's very visible. It's demonstrably problematic. There's the other issue that, thankfully, people are talking more and more about now, and that's the more subversive, the more subliminal Zionist influence. And I say Zionist because I'm using that word very specifically. I'm not referring to Jews necessarily. I'm referring to this blind, unquestioning support of anything to do with Jewish people and Israel. So this can also come from evangelical Christians.
Yes, and that's something I've become aware of. And, you know, I was brought up to support the Jews. I went to an evangelical church when I was younger, which had Israeli flags at the back behind the band. And that was just sort of, you know, accepted. But as I've gone along, I've realized, goodness me, you know, especially since the 7th of October, which was horrible. Of course, what Hamas did was horrible to the people that they killed and took hostages there. But since then, everyone has given total, blind, unconditional support to the state of Israel, that it can do whatever it wants back to the Palestinian people, and then now the Lebanese people, the Syrians, the Yemenis, and they're talking about bombing Iran after, you know, they already bombed Iran. They bombed an apartment building to kill the leader of Hamas there in April. But, you know, it fills me with horror, because they're committing an ethnic cleansing, at least, as the beginning of a genocide. You see, 50,000 approximately people have been killed in Gaza, 30,000 plus women and children. And they look at the Palestinians as subhumans. Netanyahu even calls them Amalek, which means they're subhumans that are to be completely destroyed, completely wiped out. And some people have this view. And a lot of Christians are just going along and supporting this and saying, yeah, that's right, they deserve it. And I'm saying, no, this is wrong. How can you support this genocide that is beginning in Palestine and now Lebanon as well? But I get back the answer, well, this is God's chosen people and you must support them. He who blesses Israel will be blessed and he who curses Israel will be cursed, which actually is a misinterpretation and a perversion of a verse in Genesis 12, which is talking about Abraham and in his seed, Jesus. It's not talking about the nation of Israel at all, but there's so much groundwork has been laid within the evangelical churches for 200 years to get them to support a nation of Israel, which is not the real Israel of God.
It comes from Schofield and Darby and that PSYOP just over 100 years ago, and people don't seem to realize this. I mean, if you just look at the Bible, Dave, it doesn't actually say anything about the modern state of Israel. And when it talks about God's chosen, it talks about the descendants of Jacob. That's a far jump from what we see today.
Absolutely. And people who speak to me about this, they quote some obscure bits of the Old Testament, like Zechariah, but completely ignore all of the New Testament, which says, you know, there is no Jew nor Greek anymore. He who is not a Jew who is one outwardly, he is a Jew who is one inwardly, meaning you're a child of God if you have salvation in your heart. It's about your heart. It's not about, you know, your bloodline. You know, even John 1 says they gave the right to be children of God, not of blood, nor of flesh, nor of the will of a man, but through God. You know, so you're born of God, you're born of the Spirit through the work of Jesus now. And the people who talk about the nation of Israel being God's chosen people in the 21st century completely ignore the New Testament, you know, because there's nothing in there about that. And there's nothing in there about a rapture either, or Jesus coming to rule with the Jews as the supreme people.
Yes.
That goes completely against everything in the New Testament.
You know, it's also weird to me, though. What a raw deal for those of us who are not Jews. Imagine being God's chosen people and you've rejected him for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fantastic. You can do whatever you want.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, I suppose some people think they can, but you know, the Jews who are, you know, believing this, they've got their own religion, obviously, and it's the Talmud. And you see, this is a horrible book. But it is the main book of modern Judaism. And I never heard of the Talmud until about 3 years ago, because, you know, this is one of the good things about everything that's happened. I'm starting to look at all kinds of things and I'm being made aware of more and more things. And the Talmud is horrendous, but it is actually a book of Jewish supremacism. The Jews are supreme over the Goyim. The Goyim are considered to be animals. And a Jew can kill a Goyim, but a Goyim cannot kill a Jew. It even says, kill the best of the Goyim in the Talmud, among many, many other things, which are even more horrific. And people who believe this and believe they are God's supreme people actually genuinely believe that the state of Israel is God's plan for his chosen people. And he's going to bring back a Messiah, and another Messiah is going to come. But that's out of their rejecting Jesus, who is the real Messiah. And the shocking thing and the very strange thing to me is a lot of Christians go along with this and actually start quoting the Talmud as though, you know, actually pretending to be Jewish, cosplaying as a Jew is a good thing, you know, which is, it's not, it is all through history, Christianity and Judaism have been separate religions and, you know, had that understanding until the 1930s, when this propaganda phrase, Judeo-Christian, began to be spoken. And the reason for that was to get Jews and Christians in America together to fight Hitler and the Second World War. But it's actually, there is no commonality between modern Judaism, which is based on the Talmud, and Christianity, which is based on the Bible, including the New Testament, because, you know, the position of Jesus is completely different and completely opposite. In Christianity, Jesus is the savior. In the Talmud, Jesus is being punished forever in boiling excrement. It's horrible and blasphemous and disgusting what they say. And you know, we need to understand that.
It also says, I remember reading a translation somewhere from the Talmud that says Jesus was raised from the dead by basically magicians and sorcerers and that sort of stuff, which is...
Yeah, it says Jesus is a sorcerer, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's bonkers.
It is. It's not true. And, you know, it was written down in the first to the fourth century, but it's completely antithetical to Christianity and to the Old Testament, which all look forward to Jesus coming as the Messiah. You know, I think there's 311 prophecies or something like that in the Old Testament that talk about Jesus coming, and they were all fulfilled, you know, exactly to the letter. If you look into it properly, you know, there's no question that Jesus wasn't the Messiah. He was. But, you know, a lot of Jews accepted him, of course. St. Peter, St. Paul, Matthew, Mark, John, all the people that wrote the New Testament, and many, many others, Barnabas, they became Christians. But some Jews didn't. They rejected Jesus and then created or developed another religion, which is specifically based on rejecting Jesus as the Messiah and looking for another Messiah to come in the future with a Jewish geopolitical kingdom. You know, and that's one of the errors that Jesus actually had to get rid of in his own disciples and apostles, because some of them were looking for that themselves, like Simon the Zealot. He was looking to kick out the Romans and establish a Jewish kingdom. And Jesus was saying, no, this is my kingdom is of the Spirit. You know, it's not a geopolitical kingdom. It's a kingdom for everyone to have their sins forgiven and to come into right relationship with God. And it's not just for the Jews, Judeans, ethnic Judeans. It's for everybody. Everywhere, you know. So now, as I said, now there's no Jew nor Greek, and we're all one in Christ, which was fantastic and marvelous. And, you know, the great thing is, in Israel today, despite all of that, there are 30,000 Messianic Jews, ethnic Jews, who have become Christians. So, you know, the word of God is going even to the Jews who have, you know, mostly rejected Jesus through 2,000 years. There are more and more Messianic Jews today. And that's a great thing. I'm very happy about that. But when you're talking about the Holy Land, if you like, there are many, many more Palestinian Christians than Jewish Christians. There's 200,000 plus Palestinian Christians, mostly in the West Bank. They're Orthodox. There's still a few thousand in Gaza. And what I think is shocking is that the Christians in the West have been psyoped into supporting the state of Israel above supporting our own brothers and sisters who are Palestinian Christians, who are actually being bombed and oppressed by the Jewish state there, the state of Israel, or Israel in inverted commas, as I say.
And I've been trying to get a coherent answer from anybody over the last year who isn't a Jew and who isn't an Israeli citizen. Why do you stand with Israel if you don't have a dog in that fight? They cannot answer. My only conclusion, Dave, is that they are psyoped, they are propagandized into that Schofield Derby dispensationalist idea that Israel is the chosen land, and therefore if you're a Christian, you need to support it or else. And that's taken over American Christianity.
It has, particularly evangelical churches there. And there's a huge operation to get people to believe this and to keep people in that circle, if you like. So there's an organization called Christians United for Israel, run by John Hagee. And yeah, he's one of the biggest cheerleaders for the nation of Israel, will collect money, send it to Israel. And he obviously gets a lot of support from the very powerful Jewish lobby in the United States in order to keep that going. But it keeps Christians blindly supporting Israel as though they think this is the right thing to do. You see, a lot of people are just, they're taught this by their pastors, and it's passed down from generation to generation now, because this is something that, as you said, started with Darby in 1830 and then the Scofield Study Bible in 1909 with all the erroneous notes in it saying that the Jewish state was part of God's plan. That's not in the Bible, it's only in the notes. But a lot of people have gone through Moody Bible College and other evangelical seminaries where they've used the Scofield Study Bible, and they've taken on this errant theology, which I think is a heresy, and they teach it. They teach it in their churches because it's in the Scofield Study Bible notes, and they're looking at it as though this is what the Bible actually says and means, but they're not doing actual proper exegesis and hermeneutics of the Bible. And so you're now in a situation where you've got tens of millions of evangelicals in America. The faith of evangelical churches is being dumbed down with, you know, sort of music and church services which are more emotional and experiential rather than based on solid sound teaching and doctrine and, you know, intelligence, along with this massive operation to get people to support Israel as though they think it's the right thing to do. And the heresy here is that God has two different people. I mean, this is not true. There's one people of God, and we're all together in the church. But the heresy here is that God has two peoples. There's the church, and then there's the Jews. And the Jews are really God's people. And the church is just something that happened by accident because the Jews rejected Jesus in the first century. But it's not, you know, it's not really God's plan. We're all going to be taken out of the way in the rapture, which actually isn't in the Bible at all, but a lot of people believe this. And then God's going to go back to the Jews. And so everything that's happening now is all God's plan to set up a Jewish state in the Middle East, which will then expand and eventually become the prime nation that is, you know, has the place that the United States has today and more. That's what they believe. And it's not in the Bible. It's just not. So people need to go back to their Bibles and actually find out what the Bible actually says, not what John Hagee says, not what Christians United for Israel says, not what the Talmud says or APAC says. Look at what Jesus says. And it's about everybody coming to the cross, having your sins forgiven, whether you're Jew or Gentile, doesn't matter. It's all the same now.
Have you noticed, Dave, that there's a weird kind of split in sort of legacy, traditional right-wing conservatism on this? And just as a disclaimer, I'm open to the discussion that left and right doesn't really matter that much anymore. It's become very irrelevant. But just for the sake of what we're about to talk about, we'll just assume that there is a sort of traditional right that has split on this issue of Israel. Have you noticed that?
Absolutely. And I find myself in the minority of the split. And yeah, look, I'm very, very comfortable being called a right-wing politician, even a hard right. I often get called far right, which is ridiculous. I don't even know what that means, to be honest. But yeah, you know, you're right. It's because what does right mean? What does left mean? There's a lot of people on the right that I really wouldn't agree with on some of their positions, particularly the neocons, which seem to want constant, continual war. And even Thatcherites, you know, even Thatcherite, not free market, but global free trade economics, which would open up our own industries to be pillaged and destroyed. I mean, I'm for a degree of protectionism over our own industries and our own workers. So, you know, there's positions on the right that I don't agree with, and I actually, on those issues, would agree more with the left. But yeah, so I do see what you mean. But in terms of sort of the free speech right, if you like, you know, there has been, since the 7th of October, something I find quite disturbing as well, because up until that point, everyone is saying, we want free speech, you know, free speech for everybody. Everyone should be allowed to say whatever they want, as long as they're not inciting violence or inciting crime, which is what I say. Free speech for everybody, even if their speech is offensive and you don't like it, we need to accept, you know, everyone has the right to say what they wanted, like Voltaire. In the past, you know, I hate what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it. But since October the 7th, there have been pro-Palestine marches every week in London. There have been pro-Israel marches most weekends. And a lot of people on the free speech right have suddenly started saying, well, the pro-Palestine marches are hate marches. They're terrorist marches. They're pro-terror marches. And they need to be banned. which I find very disturbing. And I actually support a lot of the, what they're saying, because I agree with them that it's wrong for the nation of Israel to be indiscriminately carpet bombing Gaza and starting a genocide. I agree, that's wrong. But there's a lot of people on the free speech right who are anti-woke, and I am as well, who have tied up being anti-woke with being pro-Israel. And I think there's two reasons for that. The first reason is because some genuinely are Zionists and they're pro-Israel and they genuinely support Zionism and the Zionist project. And probably a lot of, some of them get some money from them as well, which is why they support it. But there's other people who are supporting Israel as a bulwark against Islam and also against wokery, because the pro-Palestine movement is seen as part of the left and it's very tied up with intersectionality. I think wrongly, but you've got, you know, you've had the LGBTs and you've had the feminists and you've had the Black Lives Matter and you've had mass immigration. They're all sort of a, you know, a blob of people. You get the same people going to those different concerns, marches, you know, interchangeably, as well as the climate alarmism. And the pro-Palestine marches seem to be added to that, which is why you very bizarrely get Queers for Palestine as suddenly being created. I don't understand that, because queers are not going to survive in Palestine very much, you know, for a very long time at all. But because the Palestine issue is seen as part of the intersectionality of the left, some people on the right who up to 7th of October have been all for free speech have just unthinkingly said, well, that's on the other side. So we're against that, and we're going to, you know, do everything we possibly can to smear that and propagandize against it. Whereas I think that you need a lot more thought. And, you know, my position is really that I don't want people to die. I don't want Israel and Palestine to be killing each other by the thousands and then the tens of thousands and then the hundreds of thousands.
It's a very tricky game, this. But if I'm being honest, I don't care more for what's going on in Gaza than, say, what's going on in Ukraine or what's going on in Rwanda or some other country, because the way I'm seeing it is that innocent people, a mother holding her child, no matter where in the world she is, doesn't deserve a missile, right? But what's happened is because of Zionism and evangelical Christianity, which is so, so strong, you can't help but, like with the eye of Sauron, keep focusing on Israel and Gaza. And you don't want to elevate, see, I've got to be careful what I say here, because I don't want to diminish what's going on, but you don't want to elevate it so that it's worse than somewhere else, because there's a lot of catastrophes happening all over the place, but nobody cares. Have you noticed? Nobody cares about other parts of the world. They only care about what happened on October the 7th in Israel.
Well, on the 17th of September that same year, Azerbaijan invaded Artsakh, Nagorno-Karabakh, and ethnically cleansed 120,000 Armenians. And nobody cared about that. I mean, it hardly got any mention in the news at all. And that's more people and more horror there. That happened very, very quickly. The conflict in the Congo, conflict that's ongoing between Ethiopia and Eritrea, Thailand and Burma. Yeah, I know. I agree with you.
I think what I'm trying to say is that the media, the establishment, has a very clever mechanism of directing people's attention. To end COVID, they quickly focused on Putin and his invasion of Ukraine. And then when that got boring, they quickly shifted gear and went to the Middle East, to Gaza. And they control what people think.
Yeah, they control what people are talking about as well. It's dreadful, you know, because I'm not on the mainstream media. I don't think you're on the mainstream media, but still, they set the conversations that people are having, because they say, this is important. Israel's important. Today, it's Hurricane Milton is important. What's happening in Florida? A couple of weeks ago, it was what was happening in North Carolina. Then a few months ago, Trump was nearly assassinated. But then they suddenly will kill a story and not talk about it. We saw that with the murders in Southport in the UK. It was all over the news for 3 days, and then they killed it and didn't talk about it again. And then everyone just moved on. But the people there are still suffering from the effects of that. So, yeah, I mean, we're all in the 24-hour news cycle, and whatever is on the mainstream media still spills over onto social media, where, you know, we speak and we put our content, and it affects what we talk about as well. I mean, when my might not have the same views on all of the issues, but they do set some of the conversations. Yeah, that's true. And it's unavoidable.
I like what you said there. We may not have the same views on all things. And that kind of feeds into my earlier comment about the less or the lower degree of importance of the left and the right. Now, I don't mind being called right-wing. I'm often called far-right like yourself. But the point I'm trying to make is, what does it mean? What do these terms mean anymore? Because nobody defines them. And so they just mean anything. I've noticed, for example, in doing my podcast and TNT show, I could have the best conversations with communists. And we would suddenly agree on so many things. And then I would go back later that evening to myself thinking, I'm confused. You know, we're supposed to be enemies.
Yeah, I've had the same as well. You know, Aaron Bastani, for example, from Novara Media, who's very much on the left, we go on a show and we'd pretty much agree on most things, which is like, oh, that's very interesting. I wasn't expecting that. And even someone who's very hostile, something might come up about war, for example, and we'd suddenly agree completely on one issue. Whereas I might have someone on the old right, you know, from the old fake Conservative Party who's like gung-ho for prolonging the war in Israel and Ukraine, and they would like lay into me as irresponsible and a terrorist supporter and all these kind of things. But these smears that people throw out, that's what they are. They're just smears. Far right, bigot, homophobe, Putin's puppet, granny killer, COVIDiot. I've had them all. You've had them all. And they keep inventing new smears every year for each new issue that comes along. But, you know, I've had so many of them. It's like I collect them like badges of honor these days. I've got them all.
It's like Pokemon. It's like Pokemon, dude. You're collecting them all.
Right, yeah.
When somebody calls me an anti-Semite for criticizing Israel, because that's the catchphrase, you know, you're anti-Semite, or you're anti-Semitic, my response is, well, no, I'm not anti-Semitic. I've got nothing against Arabs. And that's the thing. Have you noticed how a lot of people also don't know the meaning of the word? I mean, it comes from Noah's son, Shem.
Yeah, it's another phrase, isn't it? It still has a little bit of power to try to shut someone up and smear someone and make someone out to be beyond the pale and degenerate in their thought. That's why people use it. But it's used to shut down criticism of the state of Israel or the Talmud or even individual Jewish people who are doing dreadful things, like Jeffrey Epstein, for example. How dare you mention that Jeffrey Epstein is a Jew? Well, he is. And, you know, what are that's just a fact, you know, we're going to talk about it.
I think it was Jesse Lee Peterson. So he did this great series of videos where he went onto the street, these blacks. So he would go and ask black people questions, you know, cultural stuff about white people. And the one woman says, no, this white man was racist towards her. And he says, well, have you ever considered that he just doesn't like you?
Oh, that's good.
And that is exactly it. You know, I don't know Epstein, but I probably wouldn't like Epstein.
No, I mean, again, I don't know, but I certainly don't like what he did. And, you know, he obviously died or not, who knows, you know, whether he has or whether he's been taken into witness protective custody or whatever, who knows. But yeah, I certainly, you know, it's absolutely horrendous that, so, you know, what he did. Harvey Weinstein, he's another one.
Yeah.
You know, so dreadful attitude to women and the things he did there. So you can't say that, you know, everyone from this ethnic group is good, because there are some good people, there are some bad people, like in every group. And you shouldn't be smeared as an anti-Semite just for pointing out what one individual person has done.
It's funny, though, because in the last few years, what's been going on sort of geopolitically has completely overshadowed anything that's been happening culturally. But I've often argued that culture is upstream from everything else.
Yes, upstream from politics and upstream from finance and business and how things happen. You are right to some extent, but I also think that things can feed into culture as well. So, you know, I might actually, as a Christian, sort of suggest that our spirituality feeds into culture, and then that feeds downstream from there. It's what is in our heart. What are our underlying principles, values? Values is a more of a wishy-washy word, but, you know, what are our principles as a nation? What is our vision? Who are we as people? And I think we're lost. Culturally, we're lost. We don't know who we are. We don't know what we believe. We don't know what we want. We don't have any vision for the future much, because we're so bombarded with all kinds of things which antagonize us that people are just struggling to live and get by day to day, physically, financially, and also emotionally as well. So the culture has been systematically hollowed out and destroyed. And what was there before, we don't have. So perhaps that is the same. Perhaps that is one and the same, the culture and the spirituality of a nation, because a nation that knows who they are, knows who their God is, knows where they've come from, has a connection to the past and has a stake in the future, will be a strong nation, will be resilient in their soul. We don't have that in the West because that has been attacked relentlessly for 60 years or more. And, you know, there's you and I and other people are trying to say, well, let's rebuild this again. And that's great because even though we've had so much hostility, so much has come against us, there are still people who want to restore what we had before. And I do believe that we can do it with God's help.
My wife made a very good point a while ago. She said that a lot of people in the West are defeated. You know, I mean, 1 million abortions annually just in the United States, Dave. Women who are aborting are not almost never being forced to. They're making this choice themselves. That's what my wife means by them being defeated. They're doing it to themselves.
You know, abortion is a horror. It's 250,000 in the UK now. One in three pregnancies ends in an abortion in the UK. It's absolutely horrendous. And people talk about the population is now decreasing, the indigenous population is decreasing. Well, that's because we're killing a third of our children in the West. It's horrific.
The actual acceleration has switched now because there is now, if I remember correctly, in almost all countries, it's now two kids per family or below that, which means that they're not replacing themselves plus adding another, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the replacement total fertility rate is 2.1, I think. So, you know, to allow for some people dying. But in the UK, among the white population, it's about 1.4. Most countries around Europe and North America, total fertility rate is between 1.3 and 1.6, well below replacement rate. We're breeding ourselves out of existence, basically, because collectively, we're not having the children to even replace the population. But the population is still going up in the UK, one, because of migration from the Middle East and Africa, and also because ethnic groups have a much higher total fertility rate. So Afghans, Somalis, Pakistanis, Indians, Bangladeshis living in the UK have a total fertility rate much higher than 2.1, you know, three or four. So they're having more children per mother, and they're having children younger. So the gap of years between the generations is lower. So the populations of those ethnic groups that are now established in the UK are growing, you know, almost exponentially.
So do you think that it's by design or by emergence? I mean, for me, the mass vaccination campaign was a combination of deliberately trying to kill and harm people, but also to reduce population growth.
Yeah, I think so. There's all kinds of things that are happening. It's not by accident that everything that's happening seems to be to reduce the population, to make life worse for the people who are around in the nations that we see, and to come against them. Yeah, obviously you've got replacement migration. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's on the UN's website. You've got the injections, which 3 or 4 years afterwards now we know of leading to a much higher mortality rate among people who've had the injections that didn't. And you've got the whole LGBT stuff, which we're told, oh, you must support, otherwise you're homophobic or transphobic. But you know, by encouraging people to pursue homosexual relationships and to get their bits cut off, there's an increase in sterility. You know, because once you've had a transgender mutilation happen, you're sterile. You're never going to have children again. You know, it's impossible. And obviously, homosexual couples, they won't be able to have children either. So everything that is being done seems to be to militate against the population increasing and actually to try to decrease the population. And disturbingly also, you've got these end-of-life care pathways, as they're called in the UK. There's something called the Liverpool care pathway, which is essentially if someone looks, you know, like they're bad, you don't resuscitate them. You just withdraw nutrition from them and let them die. And that was happening to a lot of people in so-called care homes. in the lockdown and injection period. And now they're trying to bring in assisted dying or state-sponsored killing, as it should be called. That's always been illegal in the UK, but this new government is supporting a bill to bring in euthanasia. So for the first time, people will be able to kill someone and not go to prison for it.
Or as we like to call it in South Africa, violence.
Yes, right. Yes, that's what it is, essentially, yes.
Or more specifically, Friday night.
Yes, right. I've been to South Africa. I loved it. It was 25 years ago, but I think Friday nights are a bit feisty there.
If you live here, you need to be armed. By the way, you said you were here. Where did you visit? Cape Town.
So, yeah, I went to Cape Town. I actually spent 2 years working as a teacher in Botswana over 1990.
Well, that's not South Africa.
No, it's not. No, Botswana is very, yeah, very relaxed, actually. But I traveled in my holidays. So okay. Millennium time, I did a really great trip all around South Africa. You know, went round Kruger to St. Lucia, Durban, all around the south coast to Knysna, then Cape Town, and then went back to Botswana through Kimberley. So did a really nice trip.
I love that you're pronouncing the names correctly. Do you know how many people from overseas have been here and they get the names wrong? And I understand it, but it's lovely to hear the correct pronunciation.
Oh, great.
Kruger, I'm so glad you went there. My wife and I love Kruger. We were there just a few months ago. We try and do a big game park trip every year. We love the Kruger National Park. I think it's one of the most beautiful game parks in the world, and it's massive.
Yes, yeah, it's fantastic. It's one of the easiest to go to, I think, because there's a lot of facilities there. Like, you can go and you don't have to be camping right in the bush. it's easy access, but it's huge and it's beautiful. Yeah, I loved it.
You can actually fly into the game park and land at one of the campsites. That's how big it is. So just for those who don't know, David, the Kruger Park is about the size of Israel. So it's the size of a country. It's very, very big.
Yes, yes.
How can I follow you, Dave?
So I'm on Twitter. That's my main platform. I've got 160,000 followers there.
Twitter, X.
I still say it. It's still lodged in my mind, you know. X. I'm on X at David Curtin. I've got my own website, davidcurtin.net. And then to the Heritage Party. And the Heritage Party, I'm the leader of. And that website is heritageparty.org. So you can follow me on any of those places.
What do you make of Elon?
I think he's positive. I think he's overall more positive than negative. You know, I'm very glad that he bought X, Twitter, and turned it into X, and we have free speech. There are some things that he's into that are very bizarre, like neural links and, you know, putting chips in people's brains. And I really don't like that stuff, you know, and the whole
electric cars,
you know, I think they... dying. Who wants an electric car anymore? I mean, electric cars need to be refueled by diesel generators most of the time. I mean, it's absolute nonsense, really.
Dave Curtin, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks, Jeremy.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.